50.
Oh, hey, Watson.
Just getting jacked up for the summer with my pull-up routine.
No, Buzz. We get jacked up because electric rates often go up during the hot summer months. Good thing people can lock in an affordable electric plan with APG&E.
Learn more at APGE.com.
Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Cullerton.
With Nifty Business, the fleet management specialists. Keeping your business fleet moving with service you can count on.
This is News Talk.
Well, hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. Coming up on today's show, is the energy crisis going to drive up the motivation for us to be kinder to the environment? Is the chaos in the Middle East airspace going to reap rewards for Europe's struggling airlines? Plus, what the government could learn from Sweden when it comes to helping the public to save money. Now, you can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on socials at Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now, I'm going to start off this week by explaining to you what LNG is and why many of us are talking about it, but more of us should be talking about it at the moment. So LNG is liquefied natural gas. And that is gas that has been cooled so that it's colourless, non-toxic and a liquid state. But here's the really important part. In terms of transportation, it reduces its volume by about 600 times. Now, it's dominated in or by Qatar, which produces 20% of the world's LNG. The reason I'm bringing this up to you is the price of it is up about 40% since the beginning of the war, and Europe is heavily exposed to liquefied natural gas or LNG markets. And with imports now accounting for a large share of its supply after shifting away from Russian pipeline gas. So while there's a lot of focus on the price at the diesel or the petrol pump this week, look out for what's going on with LNG, as that's actually what's driving up electricity and heating costs. And also, I'm going to be picking up on this later on in the show as well, but that's the one to watch out for. Now, today we're looking at a potentially major shift in how people in Ireland save and invest. Tánaiste Simon Harris has signalled a strong interest in a Swedish-style savings scheme. That's a tongue twister in itself. That could allow people to invest with low and in some cases no tax. But what would that actually mean for you and me? What could it mean from the perspective of investing and making investing more accessible to what the minister calls Middle Ireland as well? So I'm joined now by Irish Times personal finance writer Fiona Redden to take us through all of this. First off, Fiona, what is the state of play with Irish savings at the moment?
Yeah, hi, Susan. So at the moment, I mean, the Irish people tend to be very good savers. We have about 170 billion on deposit, which is huge. Interest rates aren't great. And not only that, but a lot of that money is actually on overnight rates. So it's earning, you know, as little as 0.1%, 0.001% in some cases. So while we're very good at putting away our money, we're not great at getting a return on it. And I think this is part of the reason why Simon Harris is stepping in with the savings product to try and, you know, protect our wealth, as it were, and let that wealth grow by getting a better return on the money.
Do you think the reason for that is because we don't have enough options, we don't have enough education, we haven't time, it's not in our culture? Why is it, as you say, that Irish or people in Ireland are good at saving but not great at getting a return on it?
Yeah, I suppose it's down to a combination of factors, isn't it? I mean, culture is definitely one thing. You know, in the US, they're just more open to investing. I think it's more common. Lack of money, obviously, in some cases, you know, people you think to invest, I'm going to need a lot more money, whereas I can save from a tenner a month or something. And that's not true, but that's a perception that people can have. And also it's fear and past experiences. I mean, we had, you know, major public listings, companies like Aircom, a lot of people lost their money on that. Then you had the bank crash. People had their money in AIB, Bank of Ireland, waiting for, you know, depending on those dividends for retirement income. And that blew up on them. So there is a fear, you know, that people would prefer to get their money back than risk, I think, earn a bit more, but maybe not get your money back, if that makes sense.
And yet, Fiona, if we look around the world, there is inspiration for us to look at about where people can do both, where they can get a higher return, perhaps in a tax sheltered sort of an instrument without taking the risk on the stock market. Can you point us towards any of those schemes around the world that we can learn from?
Yeah, I mean, so there's a couple of these, right? Just across the water in the UK, they have what's known as an ISA, an ISA, and that allows you to put up to £20,000 a year into, say, you can put it into cash or you can put it into the stock market, and that you can, that can grow tax-free. That's a huge incentive compared to here, where if you invest today, you'll pay anything up to 55%, depending if it's a gain or income, you know, on your investment, which is a hefty stake. So if you look at the UK, you could get that. Sweden also has one that's similar, that has a slight tax charge. It's about 1%. So again, it's very attractive, isn't it? And I think there's a limit of about 28,000 a year euro in how much you can put into that
so
and get the benefit.
This sounds to me like almost like a pension, whereby when you put the money, it can roll up tax free, obviously without the tax relief going on at the beginning. But the thing is, you can put £20,000 a year or 28,000 into the Swedish system every year. So this isn't just
every
a once
year.
Off. Okay.
No, and I mean, you know, you mentioned pension, but I suppose the big advantage with something like this would be that you can get it out. Because, yeah, you know, people, again, with pensions, they can kind of think, oh, I don't want to put my money into my pension, even though there's tax incentives of doing so, because I can't get it back out if I need it. But with savings product like this, you would be able to access it. In the UK, yeah, with the ISA product, they also have what's known as a lifetime ISA. Now, you can only put in less, but you can put up to 4,000 a year and you get a 25% bonus on that. And that's aimed at two cohorts, either first-time buyers saving for their home or those for their pension. So that's also an attractive offering.
Also, the big difference that you're describing to us there is these go on, we'll say, into perpetuity or forever. If we contrast that to the SSIA back in the day that led to a million people signing up for this once-off opportunity that the government was going to make a contribution towards, and that led to 15 billion euro maturing into the economy in 2006 and 7. What do you think the SSIA behaviour told us about the Irish saver?
Well, I suppose the big thing there, Susan, is, you know, talking about investing, is that most people, I don't have the exact figures, but most people did put their money into deposit type accounts. Mm. And the ones that went for, you know, the equity type SSIA did way better than the deposit holders. So again, even back then, you know, there was a reticence or reluctance to put your money in the markets. But people did avail of it. And there was a big, you know, boom at the end. I suppose with something like this, there'd be no post SSIA boom, because, as you say, it'll just be going on in perpetuity. So people will withdraw at different points in the economic cycle. So,
in hindsight, Fiona Manny commented that that money came into the economy just at the wrong time. A stimulus came into an already overheated economy, and also an economy that was heading towards a really big steep cliff that was to come after it. So perhaps the ongoing nature of this would better suit the economy and indeed the personality in Ireland today.
That's possibly true. And I suppose with the SSIA, remember, you got a 25% bonus on all your savings. So that was a significant gain, wasn't it? Whereas these products that Simon Harris is talking about, I don't think there's anything like that. He's not talking about a bonus. He's just talking about allowing you to invest and not pay a hefty tax charge on it.
And so I was going to ask you that next. Will you give us a little bit more detail into what this would mean for anybody listening today? What is Simon Harris talking about bringing into the budget this year?
Well, I suppose we're not exactly clear, you know, in the finer details. He's great to come out with the proposal, but I'm not sure he's completely thought it through. But it definitely does seem like, well, he has something coming out by budget time anyway. And looking at other countries, as I've said, what you imagine is, I do know that the banks, the stockbrokers, etc., they're all looking at this now. So they're all working on a product that they can bring to market to tie in with this, just as they did with the SSAAs back in the day. So what will likely happen is, you know, you go to your bank broker and open one of these accounts. You'll be given a variety of investment options, maybe just funds, maybe you'll be able to invest in shares. We don't know exactly the finer details of it. And then on your gains, they'll be able to grow tax-free, because that's another big disincentive at the moment to investing. It's what's known as deemed disposal, which means that after 8 years, you have to pay the tax owed on your investment. So that can really, you know, hit your fund, your investment at a critical point. If it didn't come in, you're losing out on these potential tax-free gains. So,
okay, so if we delve into what the real incentive here is, it is the fact that when one would save and perhaps through an investment vehicle, it would grow tax-free. That really is the crux of why somebody would sign up for this when it comes in.
Absolutely, yeah. And it is a big it's a big incentive, you know, because capital gains tax is 33%. But then if you draw down income from an investment, that's as much as 55%. So, you know, that's a significant saving there on your gains. Of course, you know, if you invest, it could go the other way as well. And you might have no gains.
And of course, the other thing too, though, that this could do, Fiona, is that it could simply get people more into the culture of putting money into something that would put money away until tomorrow, whether that might be savings or investment. Is this also the objective, or what has the result been in these other parts of the world, like Sweden?
Yeah, they tend to be very successful, you know. And again, this is something, it's not just Simon Harris, this is coming from an EU level as well, the Savings and Investment Union. They can see as well that Europe is lagging behind countries like the States in terms of investing. And it does have an impact, you know, on our wealth. If that's only growing at 0.5% in the deposit account, whereas if you've access to the stock market, your wealth might be growing at 10%. So, you know, Europe is lagging behind other countries in that respect.
And the other thing too, of course, that Irish people have often considered property as the most natural asset class to put a significant amount of wealth, but then that's very illiquid. If they invested in a fund or in stocks, indeed, the price might be more volatile, but they can liquidate at any point. I do want to come back about the Savings and Investment Union. I have been watching this for years, Fiona, and I'm struggling to see what progress it's actually making, apart from everybody says this is a good idea. Mario Draghi also brought this up in the Draghi report almost 2 years ago now. Are you seeing any actual tangible progress at a EU level on this?
Yeah, I mean, I've been writing about this for I don't know how many years, because it just seems basic. You know, if we have a European Union, we should be able to avail of financial products right across that union. It would allow Irish people to get much better deposit rates straight away, you know, more competition for loans, mortgages. I imagine, you know, there is motivation behind it, but everything at EU level just takes a long time. But the upside, I suppose, is that if Simon Harris does bring in this product, you know, that is a real, I suppose, tangible evidence of the union doing something, if that's motivating him to do something here in Ireland.
Fiona, I have yet to see anything that is demotivating the Savings and Investment Union. I have yet to read of it. And maybe I'm reading the wrong things, but what I am wondering, though, is what is holding it back? Is it cohesion? Is it the product? Is it simply the fact that the EU has so many competing priorities? As you say, you've been writing about this for years. What's holding it back?
I mean, I don't know. It's the honest answer, but it could also be there's a lot of competing interests, you know. Do individual countries want more competition? Do the banks, financial institutions want more competition? All these kind of things can really slow down change.
You mentioned there about the US culture, and for sure, that's very tangible. In the US, there's much more of a predilection towards investing or stocks in general. People talk about having their stockbroking accounts as simply as they do their bank accounts. But when it comes to looking at investing in other businesses, there's much greater of a culture of that too. In my research of the Savings and Investment Union, one of the motivations is if we had a vehicle to convey more of the savings of European households into our own businesses, and that could be of any size, that then would unlock a lot of capital in Europe. Can you see that happening either in Ireland or further afield in the next, you know, I'm going to say 5 years?
Well, I mean, we have a certain project like that already, right? The employment and investment. So, you know, there is a history of that, right? But it does tend to be, it's more risky, you know, investing in smaller companies. So if you're trying to get people on the ground who have their money in an overnight account to make that leap from an overnight account into investing in make possibly smaller businesses, it could just be a leap too far. So they'll have to structure it in a way, I suppose, that you're targeting maybe much larger companies. I mean, it's another issue in Europe, isn't it, that companies don't go to the markets enough to raise finance compared to the States, and it can slow down their growth, and that has another impact. But whether households is the way to fund those companies, I think, remains to be seen.
Well, In the meantime, because we've spent a lot of our conversation there looking ahead, even including up to the budget this year, which would be a good few months away yet, what advice would you have for people who they might be listening to us today thinking, you know what, I have money in an account, it's not doing anything, I don't want to put it into the stock market given all the volatility that's there, but I want to make it work harder than 0.1%. What steps do you suggest they should take?
Yeah. Well, Susan, we're actually looking at this at the moment. We have a series in the Irish Times called How to Invest. And it's looking, you know, it's right across the asset spectrum from bonds, commodities, stocks, funds, etc. But I suppose there's two things to mention, isn't there? The first one is to make sure that, you know, you have your rainy day fund before you allocate any money outside of that. And if you're very risk averse, what a lot of people are doing instead of deposit accounts is something called a money market fund. So this is kind of full of short-term debt and cash funds. And it's just going to give you a better return on your money. But it is also very safe, and it's not, you know, like an equity project at all. So there's something like that. Or there's, I mean, people are flocking to gold as well, aren't they? But that price is extremely volatile at the moment. So I think you'd need to be cautious there if you're going to, you know, if you're looking to lock away your money.
Well, you know, we were talking about gold a couple of weeks ago on this show, Fiona, as, you know, the haven and the safe haven and the flight to quality. And it's had a very rocky road since
this
war.
Very rocky road.
Very rocky road, yeah. And very volatile on the way up and on the way down. And, you know, in the past, I wouldn't have put gold and volatile in the same sentence, but that's the way it is today. Thank you very much indeed for giving us a trip around the world, into the future, back into history. And finishing up with where we should put our money. I really appreciate your time today. Irish Times personal finance writer, Fiona Redden.
Thanks, Susan.
This is Susan A's Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. Up next, how the airlines industry is struggling in some places, but thriving elsewhere due to what's going on in the Gulf. Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan A's Cullerton. For my trivia this week, I was in a town in the last few days that was the birthplace of two Taoiseach. Now, I wasn't in a city. That detail is important. What town was I in? Have a think about it and I'll give you the answer at the end of the show. Now, well, after the volatility in oil price, the next most visible economic impact of the tri-nation war is the immediate downturn of the Gulf state travel hubs that many of us have grown familiar with, both as stopover points but also destinations in their own right. If the war continues, is there an opportunity for old world or traditional airlines based in Europe to begin a resurgence as they try to offer direct flights to the Far East and beyond? So to unpack this as well as a myriad of other complex factors, I'm delighted to be joined now by Anita Mendriata. So Anita, a third of European flights to Asia pass through the Gulf, and for Australasia, it's closer to half. What has the war meant for airlines to reconfigure their flight paths?
Goodness, it's been, and thank you very much for having me back. It's been incredibly complex for the airlines for a few reasons. Firstly, there are a number of, as we know, and exactly as you said, a significant number of travelers go through those Middle Eastern hubs, and the airlines rely on them for connectivity. But importantly, it's not only the hubs, it's the Middle Eastern air corridor, which effectively serves about 30% of all travel west-east, east-west. So even if aircraft are not landing in the Middle East, they're going through that air corridor, which has been heavily constrained. So to be able to actually get to the east, for instance, from Europe, the airlines have had to do some significant navigation because it's not just the aircraft landing in the Middle East, it's using that Middle Eastern corridor. And because of the conflict now and the corridor being severely restricted, it means airlines are having to divert. Those diversions cost more time, they cost more fuel. And with the price of fuel increasing dramatically, it puts enormous pressure on airlines. And they're simply choosing to cut back their schedules. It's not worth flying.
And then that, of course, presents an opportunity then, if I may be so crass to say so, for other airlines who might want to pick up on those routes or even go in a different direction if that's possible. Which airlines are looking to create new connectivity, Anita?
You're absolutely right, because what's happening is that people are not only looking at alternative routes, they're looking at alternative destinations, and people are finding that they're much more comfortable staying closer at home. So interestingly, Michael O'Leary and Ryanair has enjoyed an enormous surge in travel into Europe in the summer, rather than people going farther east. So it's really reconfiguring the entire travel network effectively going into summer and into the end of the year, as people are just not comfortable making those longer haul trips for a couple of reasons. A, there might be challenges with the airspace, or B, the flights might be canceled altogether. So rather stay closer to home and still get a break.
And there's also the opportunity cost as well. I was looking, for example, at IAG, Lufthansa, Air France, KLM. They make most of their money crossing to the North Atlantic from Europe. So if they were to look east, they may not have the capacity to service those new routes, whether it might be because they don't have the aircraft or, of course, then there's a massive labour force and all that that they might need to take on board. So what does this mean then for people who may still want to be travelling to Asia? Are they likely to find that there's simply less capacity to service them?
Interestingly, to go to Asia, you can either go from west to east or actually go backwards. So, for instance, when I was grounded in Delhi and had to find my way back to London, I ended up flying through Thailand, China, and importantly, Chinese airlines are able to fly through Russian airspace. There's no issue there with any conflict. So it opened up the opportunity for many carriers from Asia that I would not normally have considered traveling on. So there are travel choices out there for travelers. They just need to literally pivot their thinking. And so rather than going from west to east, rather start working the other way around the world. But there are definitely choices that are available.
And yet, I'm thinking too, Anita, as I talked to you in March 2026, we can often overemphasize the short term. We can think, well, you know, this is the way it is now when people are going to change their behavior. And then if the war was to end pretty quickly, and we don't know how likely that is, but what do you think then people would just return to form, start going back to Dubai as their connective hub to Australia or other destinations that they might have in the Middle East? Like, are we overemphasizing the behavioral change that we think might come from this?
I think there's a lot of learning that we see coming out of COVID, truth be told, because even when the world reopened again, people were just simply naturally nervous about traveling, being far away from home, being in an environment where they could get caught in terms of borders closing in the case of COVID. In a situation right now with the Middle East, I always separate the military action from the collateral damage. And central to travel is confidence and trust. And if people just don't feel confident about flying certain corridors, then they're going to hold back. The challenge is that those Middle Eastern carriers that we all love, whether it's Emirates, Qatar Airways, Etihad, they're outstanding airlines, superb airports, and importantly, they're very price competitive. They can be between 20 and 40% less than if you used a normal legacy carrier. So travelers are also losing that choice in terms of being able to make cost-effective decisions. And that's why, again, there's going to be an adjustment as people recalibrate. But we do know that if there's one part of the world that has the ability to recover with strength, with confidence, and with reassurance, it is that Middle Eastern strip. So I do believe that those airlines and airports will open up again. But it is a matter of being at full capacity, knowing that we have full confidence that the military action is complete.
So there's two parts of upward pressure there that I'm hearing from you in terms of price. One is the increase in the price of the jet fuel itself. But the second thing is, if a competitive force leaves the building, namely, say, Emirates or Etihad or Qatar Airways, then other airlines who might then also be experiencing increased demand for their offering, they too may not feel the pressure of trying to compete against a lower cost airline, who, of course, is a very high level of service. So all of this is pointing towards higher prices, is what I'm deducing from you, Anita. Or is there anything else that you think should be factored into the equation there?
No, I think very much it is higher prices in the short term that we know. And even with airlines, like whether it's EasyJet or Ryanair, having been able to hedge their fuel costs, when we go into the second half of the year, that's going to be more difficult. But I think what's also important, Susan, when you're speaking about is the issue of capacity. Now we know at this point in time that those Middle Eastern carriers are not operating at full capacity. But to put it in context, every single day coming out of the UK are 42 flights across Qatar, Etihad, and Emirates. That's 16 to 18,000 seats. So if those aircraft are not operating at their full schedule, we're losing huge amounts of seats that are available in the entire travel network, which means more competition, which means price increases. So sadly, there are many variables at play, but it's not only the conflict increasing the price of fuel, it's basic supply and demand. We're losing a huge amount of supply at a time where there's significant demand. And that's where we're seeing, especially, as I said earlier, the low-cost carriers are enjoying a surge because people are grabbing their holiday tickets now while they can.
When we see airlines like British Airways saying that they've cancelled all their flights to Dubai until the end of May, or we're seeing some airlines that are parking long haul aircraft in storage areas, how much of an indication should we take from that, Anita, that these airlines are saying, look, this is going to be much longer and much more difficult, and trading is going to be much more challenged than we think? What messages do you take out of those types of decisions from airlines like that?
Those are incredibly hard decisions to make, because airlines don't usually make a very strong margin to begin with. I mean, 30% of their costs are simply from fuel on a good day. So this is outside of the conflict and how the fuel is increased. And no good comes out of a parked aircraft. It is obviously not generating any revenue. It's not being able to satisfy its customer base. So those are very hard decisions to make. But equally, airlines are just saying, and I was speaking to an airline CEO from Asia yesterday, and just saying they've had to cut back to 30% of their flight schedule because it's simply too expensive to operate right now with the cost of fuel. There's also the challenge is that when there are conflicts and aircraft are diverted and grounded, the aircraft are in the wrong position, the crews are in the wrong position, and it makes it, again, very difficult for those airlines to come back online. But at the end of the day, it is a horrible decision for an airline CEO to have to make. But they know that in the final analysis, it's the right decision until there's confidence that they can travel cost effectively and safely.
No good comes out of a parked aircraft. I think that's a really important line to take away from this. I've seen you quoted where you've said 10 to 15% of the world trade goes through aviation in the Middle East. Now that we've looked at what happens from a people perspective, what about cargo?
That's an important aspect that we often forget, because the commercial aircraft, they had cargo in the belly of the plane over and above the cargo aircraft. So if you think about it, pharmaceuticals, electronics, agriculture products, those go through aircraft, air travel. And so the cargo is also being hurt quite badly. And this is where even yesterday, when at the Global Trade Summit in Dublin, we were speaking about this, the impact on supply chains. Many companies, especially small companies, are having to actually shut down for a short period.
You know, you make a very interesting point there earlier on about the role of confidence. And when we think of the currency of confidence in tourism hubs like Dubai accommodation occupancy has dropped from a 90% peak season average to around about 16% by the 17th of March, according to Lighthouse Intelligence. So the points you make there are really, really important. Thank you indeed so much for joining me, Anita. It's a fascinating topic to just look at how entire airlines have to reposition themselves right around the world. Thanks indeed for taking the time to join us, Anita Mendriata. This is Susan Hayes Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. After the break, how the state of the world might be turning us greener. Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton. I want to read out a message that we got from a listener after last week's trivia. And the name of this listener is Ulton O'Hay, who says, "Hi Susan, loves the show. That's some cool facts about Galway. I lived there on the turn of the millennium. Good time. Apostasy was our local cafe, Dominic Street Lower. And now he's living in Cork." So thanks very much indeed for your message. But I have to tell you all listeners as well, I want to tell you what happened here in studio after I told everybody my trivia. Simon Keane was in at the time, and he responded to my trivia with some trivia of his own, which is that the Corrib in Galway is actually the shortest river in the country. So there you go. You get double. Two for the price of one this week. Now, with oil prices swinging high and low, renewed tensions in the Middle East and disruption to global supply routes, there's fresh debate about whether electric vehicles can shield households and economies from volatile fossil fuel markets. And while interest in EVs tends to spike during energy shocks, questions do remain about whether they meaningfully reduce oil dependence or simply shift where and how we consume energy. I'm joined now by Miran Lynch, Senior Research Officer at the ESRI. First off, Miran, they say the enemy of long-term investment is volatility. What is your take on the investment thesis for renewable or green energy now at the moment, given all the volatility that we're seeing in the Middle East?
So what we know from the data is that when prices increase, demand goes down. And that's true in the transport sector and also in heating and electricity sector. And we've seen that again and again. And it's probably, you know, the high prices after the Ukraine crisis and as we were coming out of COVID, are kind of the explanation for why we kind of are coming very close to hitting our climate targets as of 2025. Now, 2030 is a different story. However, when it comes to investment, people tend to need a kind of a stronger signal. So while an increase in price will reduce usage of any fuel, a tax increase is actually better at inducing decrease in usage of the fuel. And the reason for that is because people are more likely to assume that a tax will be permanent, whereas an increase in price could be temporary. So what tends to happen is when prices go crazy, people just kind of use less in the short term, maybe by driving less or turning down the thermostat. Whereas if people think prices are going to increase in the long term, that's what tends to induce them to make longer term decisions like buying an electric car or buying a more efficient car or retrofitting their house or anything like that.
And yet, though, energy demand is astoundingly high globally. When we look at that, it could be driven by the AI boom, the population growth on the planet. So the micro decision making that you're describing in the household is one thing, but the macro demand seems to be only moving in one direction.
Yep. No, energy is what we call an essential good. And the fact that economies are growing, populations are growing, and then also what we had been seeing, particularly in developed countries, was efficiency. So kind of you're getting more bang for your buck out of every unit of energy. But now, since AI and digitalization, there has been an increase in electricity demand in particular. However, industry is more easy, can kind of switch more easily between kind of different kind of fuels. And a lot of industries are looking to decarbonize by moving towards the likes of hydrogen, e-fuels and that kind of thing, even though it's not necessarily cheaper. In fact, it's probably more expensive. But I suppose it's partly them wanting to do the right thing as regards the climate, and also partly them wanting to shield themselves from the volatility on international energy markets.
But if we look at that, Muireann, and we really look into the economics of that, there's a difference between investing in something today and then the long run outcome. Because if any country, or let's say the EU in general, if it invests in capital projects right now, then the fuel is free on the back end, but the investment needs to come up front. So what's the business case like for renewable energy now?
So renewable energy in many countries is still being subsidized. But even for, in Ireland at least, renewable electricity is competitive. And there are a lot of corporate power purchase agreements being signed, which is essentially we're getting renewables onto the grid that aren't attracting a subsidy. It's just they have a private arrangement with a kind of a large company, usually a tech company. As regards other types of renewables, again, a lot of them require a subsidy, but the thing that really helps them come into their own is the fact that renewables shield you from exposure to volatility. So even if you're expecting prices to, like oil prices and gas prices, to be low on average in the long run, if there's considerable volatility around that, then there is a business case to be made for investing in an energy option that might be more expensive on average, but has less volatility around that. What we see now with Ukraine and with Iran is we've had two energy crises in the space of a few years, having not had a proper energy crisis in a few decades. So that alone might make people think, you know what, the fact that there's so much volatility here means that there's a business case to be made for switching to a more stable source of energy. Even if it's a higher cost, at least you're not going to have these massive swings.
So even though the climate targets and everything else that might drive a government, a company, a household in terms of their heart or indeed their head, the thing is now, if one wants to avoid volatility or be shielded from it, renewables sounds like a safer option to go. But if we take a global approach to this, can I ask you, do you think the US is more or less exposed to the situation in the Middle East given the shale oil revolution that they invested in over the past couple of decades?
The shale oil and gas has just totally changed the outlook in the US altogether. I mean, there were LNG terminals being built in the US with the intention of importing LNG because the US figured that they weren't going to have enough piped gas available to them. And those terminals are now being used to export LNG as a result of shale. So it has totally shifted the balance in terms of how much energy the US imports versus how much it kind of self-consumes. But because these commodities are global and because the prices are set globally, once kind of something like Strait of Hormuz gets closed, then that affects prices for everyone everywhere. And it really doesn't matter what access you have indigenously or otherwise, because these commodities are totally interchangeable, because a barrel of oil is a barrel of oil, no matter where it comes from and no matter where it goes. That means that if the price goes up anywhere, it goes up everywhere.
After we had the supply chain shocks of COVID, there was this move towards deglobalization where suddenly supply chains were being looked at not just through the lens of price, but also what if something goes wrong, we can't get things. And there was certainly a move towards localization at the time. Do you think that's underway now when it comes to energy and energy security as well?
To some extent, I think a lot of it depends on what is local, what we mean by local. So if we look at something like gas storage, most countries like Europe invested heavily in LNG in the wake of the Russian crisis, because people saw how helpful it is to have access to hydrocarbon fuels in your own country on your own doorstep. The fact that Ireland has no gas storage is it leaves us pretty exposed. On the other hand, if you look at renewables, one of the best ways to ensure supply of renewables is to diversify geographically, because, okay, if it's windy in Ireland, it's more likely to be windy in Britain at the same time. If it's not windy in Ireland, it's less likely to be windy in Britain at the same time, but it might be sunny in Spain. So from a renewables perspective, there's been a lot of increased investment in interconnection, and there are a lot of interconnectors that the European Commission has designated as PCIs. These are these projects of common interest, and the interconnector between Ireland and France is one of them. So I think as regards hydrocarbons and stuff, yeah, it's about having more locally, whereas as regards renewables, it's about actually having greater access to geographic spread, and that in turn also boosts security.
If we look at the push and pull factors around renewables, some of the things that would pull us towards doing this is, as you say, having security, diversification of supply and so on, and also there can be price factors too. But one of the reasons that we as a country might be pushed away from this is the security of actually having a reliable supply all the time. Is battery storage the simple answer to that?
Battery storage is part of the solution, in that batteries at this point are just very competitive, not just because of the fact that they store energy, but also because they can respond so quickly. When we saw the massive blackout in Spain and Portugal and France during the summer, that just wouldn't have happened in Ireland, because we have a lot of technology on our system that can respond so quickly to these system-wide events. And what really happened, well, I mean, a couple of things went wrong at the same time. But if they had had the kind of fast-responding technologies that we have in Ireland, then they wouldn't have seen that blackout. When it comes to ensuring security, even in a high renewables world, really all you need there is you just need to make sure you have enough what we call conventional or thermal plants on the system to cover your peak demand, so that even if there's no wind and there's no sun, you can still cover your peak demand from conventional units. So the thing is, the need for conventional units has not gone away. It hasn't been increased or decreased by the advent of renewables. The renewables just do their thing on the side, but you always need enough conventional generation. Batteries can take the place of some of that conventional generation, and the case for batteries gets better and better as you get more renewables. But it's just quite boring, really. Like, if your peak demand is 7,000 megawatts, you need 7,500 megawatts or so of conventional generation. And that is the case whether you've no wind on the system at all or whether you've got loads and loads and loads of wind.
You make it sound so simple. If you need 7,000 megawatts, you just have 7,500. It's simple as that. Muireann, as I'm...
It actually is.
And I'm
it actually is that simple.
Simply boring is the way you're putting it too. Can I ask though, I'm reading between the lines here, and it sounds like you're actually quite complimentary of how the Irish energy system has been developing in the area of renewables and technology. Am I right in that assessment?
Well, I mean, as regards the technical spec, we have some of the most sophisticated mechanisms in the world for making sure that we have a generation fleet that can do what we want it to do. Part of the reason for that is because Ireland is so small. A smaller system is harder to keep in balance than a big system, just because if you only have 8 units going and one of them drops off, you're in an awful lot more trouble than if you have 60 units going and one of them drops off. So in terms of kind of what we're able to do technically, Ireland is really ahead of the curve, and we're also very much ahead of the curve in terms of operating a system with these high levels of variable renewables like wind and solar. Where we fall behind is on things like costs and delivery, particularly around, this is the story across all large infrastructure, not just energy. So planning is very delayed. Environmental regulations are very cumbersome. Projects in general, they just take way longer to deliver, and they come at a way higher cost than our European counterparts. So my criticisms wouldn't be so much on the technical side of things, although our grid does need a lot of investment. My criticisms would be much more around planning and costing.
And we could have a whole other conversation about that, and we might even do that. But if I bring it back to the conversations that's been happening around the dinner table in many households over the past couple of weeks, back to the whole choice of, do we go down the road of an electric vehicle or that type of investment now taking on a new role of relevance? When we see spikes in the oil price driving interest in electric vehicles, do you think that's just a short-term behavioural response, or will it translate into lasting changes in transport demand?
So this is where we really don't know what we like, because the data that we're dealing with to date, the kind of price spikes we can look at in the past were nothing like the price spikes we've seen very, very recently. And when we had oil crises before, that was before, you know, they occurred in a context where electric vehicles weren't really a thing. And also the climate agenda was not half as robust as it is now. So what we know from the data is that price spikes tend to make people reduce their usage without investing in new stuff, whereas tax changes are more likely to make people invest in new stuff. What we don't know is whether a really big spike like this one, and in the context of massively increased global uncertainty, would that be enough to induce investment where previously simple price fluctuations would not be enough to induce investment. We just going to have to wait and see in the data. But for me personally, I mean, we've got four kids, so it's hard to get an electric car that would fit us all. But we did just get a hybrid for the first time, and I'm really glad we did once I saw where the petrol prices went a few weeks later.
Well, I can imagine so, Muireann. But I also find two other factors holding back people from going down this road. One is range anxiety. And I'd like to get your take on that and the development of it, even in the context of the decision that you made in your own household recently. And the second one is the resale value, is that the depreciation of electric vehicle has different economics to it than a traditional vehicle. What is your take on both of those? Are they overhyped now?
On the range anxiety, I think it is overhyped. Now, I'm sure there's someone listening who's just, their head is blowing at the moment saying, what are you talking about? The reason I think it's overhyped is the following. The vast majority of commutes that are taken by private car in Ireland are under 25k. Every single car on the market has a range of far in excess of 50k. So it's for anyone who's just using their car to commute to and from work, range should not be an issue. Furthermore, an awful lot of households in Ireland have two cars. Almost all of those households could have one of those cars be electric. So you've got your conventional car for the long car journeys, you've got an electric car for the short car journeys. Where range anxiety comes into play is people, they're like, oh, but what if I want to drive from, you know, Limerick to Cork or something? And it's not that no one ever has to do that, but realistically, how often do you have to do that? Yeah, some people do it regularly. Most of us do it very, very rarely. And there's increasing things like car sharing schemes. You can rent cars by the hour. You can rent cars pretty cheap for a day or two. I think it might just be a case of getting used to the idea that, well, in general, we drive our electric car 99% of the time. And then if we want to take a trip to Galway, we just rent a diesel car for the day. That is actually totally doable. And that's a model that works in other industries. But for some reason, we're still stuck on the idea that you may only have one car ever. On the resale value, again, we're only just starting to get data on this now because electric cars have been so recent, and we're only kind of starting to see significant-ish volumes in the secondhand market in the last few years. It certainly does seem to be the case that the resale value is not what we might have expected. One of the reasons possibly being that batteries do just kind of wear out over time. And especially one of the things about batteries is their range is massively impeded when it's cold. And in Ireland, it's cold a lot. So perhaps yes, those things combined mean that the resale value isn't quite what we would have originally expected it to be. But it kind of remains to be seen how all of this comes out in the wash, because you got to weigh that up against massive oil crises happening every second year, potentially. And who knows where that would all come down.
Which then brings me to my last question, because your point there, the first answer to me there was cultural, which is if we were to use the electric car 99% of the time and use hire a diesel car, let's say, or a petrol car for the longer journeys. I do want to ask one other existential question. How feasible would it be, Muireann, to electrify the majority of transport in Ireland?
The question is by when? It's happening way slower than any of the government targets were set. And the main moves on renewable transport have actually been on the biofuels obligation. That's kind of done a lot of the heavy lifting, as opposed to electric cars. I think there's probably a lot more low-hanging fruit in things like mode shifting. So this is stuff like active travel. I think it's really frustrating that stuff like small scooters and unicycles and that kind of thing have been banned from public transport, because they were the exact kind of thing that kind of opens up stuff like trains and trams and stuff to a much wider catchment area. If you can kind of do that first and last mile on a scooter or something, then you're way better off than if you have to walk that first and last mile. So that kind of thing is a real retrograde step, I think. And they were banned for rather bizarre reasons around people were afraid that they would go on fire or something, which is very strange to me. So I think in the long run, it can't just be that we all continue to have our own private car and yet that car happens to be electric. That just doesn't seem to be cutting it. I think it's going to have to include mode shifting, but whether we can do that remains to be seen.
It's been fascinating to talk to you. Muireann Lynch, Senior Research Officer at the ESRI. Thanks very much indeed for joining us.
Brilliant. Chat to you again.
Now, for my answer to my trivia that I put to you earlier on in the show, I was in a town, not a city, but a town this week that was the birthplace... That is the birthplace of two Taoiseach. Where was I? The answer was Castlebar, County Mayo, where both Enda Kenny and also Charlie Haughey were born. And the reason that I pointed out now that I wasn't in a city is because, of course, Jack Lynch and Micheál Martin were born in Cork and several other Taoiseach were born in Dublin. So that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Ace Cullerton. I hope you enjoyed the show and possibly even learned something about economics and how it affects our world. I will just remind you, this show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the Go Loud app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. We're also, of course, on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy, and on research this week was Simon Keane and Stephen Dalt. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks so much for listening and enjoy the rest of your day. I look forward to chatting to you next week, which, of course, will be Easter Sunday. Thank you all and have a lovely week.
Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Cullerton on News Talk.
With Nifty Business, the fleet management specialists. Helping businesses unlock growth with a leased vehicle fleet.